Support for State Week comes from the following sponsors: Visit Springfield, PIORG, and the Illinois Education Association.
From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
With a new fiscal year, also come some new laws. We're going to run through some of those that you should know about. We've got that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. Our guest this week, Isabella Nieto. She covers the State House for WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio stations. Isabella, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I mentioned several laws to discuss. Let's start with one of those. I know you covered this, Isabella. It's a law that's already on the books called cyberbullying, but this adds to it. It's a criminal offense. What is the approach of this legislation? What is it trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so the bill, it basically expands the definition of cyberbullying to incorporate unauthorized AI-generated images. Now, I spoke to State Representative Janet Yang Rohr of Naperville in doing a story about this bill, and she said it sort of stemmed from reports of male students making deepfake sexual images of their female classmates and posting or distributing them. So the bill basically allows for schools to make rules governing the use of AI apps to create these images and put in a framework on how schools can address instances where people are cyberbullying or students are cyberbullying each other using these types of images. So it just kind of allows a school to figure out how they can investigate, how they can discipline students for doing this sort of thing, and ways to prevent it from happening as well.
Yeah, it seemed like from your reporting, from what I understood, that was sort of the approach here, was less about the punishment aspect and more about just trying to make sure that young people will do some things sometimes, and technology allows them to do certain things, that maybe this was just about making it clear to them that this is not okay.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, to hear that students are making these types of images of each other, it's pretty shocking. It's pretty disturbing. So, you know, it's interesting that this has made its way to the legislative level. And I'm interested to see how schools decide to put in the framework that is already kind of in place in the school code about cyberbullying to kind of incorporate these images as well.
And Charlie, maybe for those that don't follow the legislature as closely, this is pretty common for legislative activity. It's basically trying to keep up with changes, technological changes, for example. Often it's reactive more than proactive. I mean, something has occurred and that, of course, spurs legislation. That seems to be what this is about here, trying to basically get out in front of some of this technology as best they can.
Yeah, and I'm not sure so much getting out in front as it is catching up. As Isabella suggested, there have been really shameful incidents of male students using artificial intelligence to do sexually explicit AI pictures and then put the face of a female classmate on that picture and then distributing them. And that's a real problem, and it's going to become greater as the AI becomes the images become more realistic. And I think it's the latest development of the kind of stuff that always has gone on, where some kids will bully other kids basically because of their own insecurity. And so if I make fun of you, Sean, it's because I'm insecure and I'm trying to prop myself up by poking fun at you, that kind of thing. And of course, with the new technology and the advances, some of these images are so realistic, you really don't know whether it's real or not. And this really causes great emotional distress on the victims. What I'm curious to see is what kind of punishment or what kind of repercussions school districts will impose on students who do this kind of outrageous behavior.
Yeah, Isabella, this is left up, you said, to the school districts to decide. So we could see policies that are more strong in some districts. Is that fair to say? Or
I think that would be possible. It really depends on how the school district wants to address these sort of things. I think the bill is mostly just adding these images to the definition of cyberbullying that's already incorporated in school codes. I think it's possible that it depends on the school district to see, you know, how strictly or how proactively, you know, the investigation goes or what the discipline looks like.
Okay. Well, there's also a new state agency that is now official, and that is called the Illinois Department of Early Childhood. It's going to be taking on programs that involve infants, toddlers, their families. And like I said, these programs range from, according to Capital News Illinois, in-home visits for newborns and their mothers to licensing and regulating child care facilities and funding preschools. These things were already covered in existing state law by other agencies, but now the idea was to give this to a new agency. Charlie, we haven't seen a new agency develop in a little while, but does this make sense to you that this is being carved out for state government?
Oh, yeah, I think it does. As a matter of fact, the governor suggested that we ought to do this 3 years ago, and it took that long for legislation to be passed and for the groundwork to be laid, and now it finally became effective, and the new agency, the Department of Early Childhood, officially came into being earlier this week. It is, you said, these are all things that exist now. These services are all being provided by the state, but they're scattered over a number of different agencies. The Department of Human Services has some. Department of Children and Family Services has some. State Board of Education has some. And some of the people who were proponents of consolidating all these in one department referred to the state's existing early childhood system as a spaghetti noodle. Another individual said it's like a spider web. All of it is so complicated. And at the end of the day, parents really don't care where the money is coming from, the help's coming from, just want to get into a program. So this will move all of these existing programs from other agencies, most of which have other priorities rather than providing this early childhood help, into a department all of its own. And as a matter of fact, the budget appropriates something like $4 billion for this. And it's not new money in the sense that this is money that's already been existing in these other agencies' budgets. And now it's going to be shifted to this new agency. So I think this is a good step in making it easier for parents to get the kind of help that they need without having to bounce around between multiple agencies and not knowing where to turn when they need this assistance.
Yeah, I think that, and Isabella, I mean, I'm sure you've talked to people who were supportive of this, sponsors and others, but it seems to me that, and I'm one of these people that often hears something like expansion of state government in some way and think to myself, oh, more bureaucracy, maybe that's not the best thing. But really, like Charlie said, this is taking staff and resources that were put in these big bureaucracies, some of these larger agencies, and carving this out to a point where maybe it works more efficiently for people.
Yeah, I think, you know, I didn't get a chance to talk to anybody about this bill in particular, but, you know, based on kind of reading the legislation, this is meant to kind of streamline the process for parents that need support from the state and in these departments as well. It kind of makes it easier for them to find it all in one place, as opposed to, you know, like Charlie said, at the Department of Human Services or the Department of Children and Family Services and things like that. So I think it kind of streamlines the process.
Well, we'll be back with more on State Week.
Support for State Week comes from Visit Springfield, featuring dozens of attractions and overnights on Route 66 in the capital city. Springfield is home to numerous Lincoln sites, Frank Lloyd Wright's Dana Thomas House, the Illinois State Capitol, and more. The Visit Springfield team can help organizers plan their event in the capital city. Attractions and tourism information at visitspringfieldillinois.com.
We're back on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler and WBEZ and Illinois Public Radio's Isabella Nieto. Isabella, one of the bills that also is taking effect really dates back to the start of the pandemic or during the pandemic, when a lot of these bars and restaurants who make a lot of their profit off of selling alcohol were unable to do so because people couldn't come into these places. And so the legislature gave them a temporary reprieve by allowing what is known as cocktails to go. It sounds just what it sounds like. Now that has actually become a state law. So tell us a little bit about this piece of legislation.
Yeah, so you're right. It did kind of start out in 2020. So in June of 2020, Pritzker signed the law that allowed the sale of cocktails by bars and restaurants with liquor licenses for pickup and delivery. It was kind of aimed at keeping businesses afloat during the pandemic when, you know, nobody could go anywhere and there was no way for restaurants to be able to continue making money. And you know, last December, Pritzker finally, you know, he signed the permanent law, making the practice permanent in Illinois law. And starting on Wednesday, actually this past Wednesday, July 1st, restaurants can now permanently offer cocktails and single servings of wine to go. And the legislation does have specific guidelines for how these drinks can be prepared for pickup and delivery. They have to be delivered by a member of someone who is employed by the restaurant that is selling the drink. So it has to be someone who is trained in the proper way to deliver it, which means that they obviously have to be 21 and they have to store the drink in an area of their car that is not accessible to passengers. So if there is a trunk, they have to transport the drink in the trunk of the car. If there is no trunk, it has to be in a cup holder or something far away from where anyone in the car can get to it. And they also have to be packaged a certain way. These single servings of wine or cocktails, they have to be packaged in a very sturdy cup it has to be brand new, and there cannot be any openings in it. It has to be sturdy so that it's not able to be tampered with. So they have to be very specifically packaged and delivered by someone who is an employment of the establishment, or for pickup, you know, it has to be packaged in those specific guidelines for the drinks themselves.
Yeah, Charlie, I know a lot of people are going to be saying, well, you know, alcohol to go, cocktails to go, that's not necessarily going to be safe, more people driving around drunk. But I guess I look at this a couple of ways. Like Isabella just said, there's a lot of different restrictions and regulations about this. And I guess nothing really stops somebody now from going to a liquor store, buying something and opening in the car if that's what they want to do. I mean, other than being caught with that. So, I mean, to some extent, I don't know that this is a huge deal from a public safety standpoint. But what are your thoughts on it?
No, I think it's basically extending a convenience that, as Isabella said, was put in at the beginning of the pandemic as a way to help these establishments survive when they lost the foot traffic. I guess it's convenient for somebody, but I'm thinking, I always thought back in the days when I would go to bars, I always thought part of it was not just going to have a beer. Part of it was the people you would meet with and the conversation and the intermingling of folks, which obviously you're not going to get if you have the local bar deliver your cocktail to your home. So I'm not sure how big a deal this will be. I guess we'll just have to wait. And I'm not seeing any statistics of how often this was used or what impact it had on the industry in the years that it's been in existence.
Well, we'll continue to follow that. Let's stay on the highways when it comes to another piece of legislation that just took effect here with the new fiscal year. This involves, Charlie, something that hits a little closer to you. It's the senior driving tests. The state of Illinois has for years had some of the most restrictive, if not the most restrictive, laws when it came to elderly people, senior citizens who drive, and basically requiring them to be tested more often. But some changes now are in effect.
Yes, they are. And in my case, the law was passed last year in the spring session, 2025, but it didn't become effective until July 1st this year. And in November of last year, I had to renew my driver's license under the old rules when I turned 84. But under the new one, I won't have to do the driving test for another couple of years. So what it says, there's for people aged 79 and 80, they don't have to do a vision test, but no driving test. And they have to renew their license in person every 4 years. For people 81 to 86, they have to have a vision test, but no driving test. They do the in-person renewal every 2 years. People 87 and older do the vision test, an annual behind-the-wheel test, and they have to renew every year. And one of the provisions that's in the law that I think is interesting, it also provides that there's a process for family members to report cognitive or physical health declines to the state for review. So if my kids decide that I'm no longer competent to drive, they can tell the Secretary of State's office and he can lift my license. So I think this is helpful. And Secretary of State Alexei Janulius points out that we still have one of the strictest renewal requirements, but in a report issued a couple of years ago, Janulius said the report showed drivers age 75 and older are involved in the least number of crashes compared to any other age group. And I think that's true. I find myself driving more cautiously than I would have done 20, 25 years ago, and paying more attention to my surroundings, that kind of thing. So I think this is a beneficial change in the law for elderly drivers.
We'll be back with more on State Week.
Support for State Week comes from PIORG, a nonprofit consulting firm providing resources for strategic planning, best practice implementation, and outcomes-focused program evaluation across the country, helping organizations make data understandable and actionable, enabling change makers to strengthen critical skills and serve others more effectively. PI, Plan, Implement, Evaluate. Services and information at PIORG.org.
You're listening to State Week. Our guest this week, Isabella Nieto, WBEC and Illinois Public Radio. Isabella, there was a lawsuit that was filed. This does not necessarily, the lawsuit itself, not part of a new law, but it was based off of a law taking effect. And this is from the prediction market Kalshi. Give us the quick update on that as far as what they're upset about at this point and what it's all about.
Yeah, so with the new state budget that took effect on Wednesday, there's a new tax on prediction market platforms. And Kalshi is a prediction market platform that engages heavily in sports betting. They also offer betting on pop culture events, on political events, and things like that. And this is a pretty popular form of betting nowadays. So the new law implements a tax on transactions made on those platforms, paid by the platform itself. So Kalshi has filed a federal lawsuit challenging the tax and alleging that it violates federal jurisdiction over prediction markets. And at the time, Crane Chicago Business reported that the Illinois Attorney General's office was reviewing the complaint. And that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the overview. They filed it in Chicago, and I am not sure if there are any super relevant updates on that just yet. But yeah, that's kind of the highlights.
Yeah, Charlie, not a surprise to see an industry being taxed filing a lawsuit. That sometimes will happen here. But this is an area that the state is focused on. A lot of states are focused on, actually.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the bottom line argument is, are these prediction markets betting, sort of like FanDuel or what are those where you can bet on, you know, will the White Sox win today or not, or bet on something? I think one of the things that in one of the prediction markets, there were reports that one of the what would you say, one of the bets you could make was whether or not Maduro would be removed from Venezuela by a certain period. And if I recall correctly, some bettors made hundreds of thousands of dollars by predicting that he would be gone by a certain date. And the question was, well, did these people have inside information? But I guess the argument is, are these prediction markets, as the Federal Trade Commission says, are they the equivalent of buying futures for next year's soybean crop or corn crop? Or are they more like betting on the outcome of events, as you would find, as I say, in the sports betting? And the Illinois considers Kalshi and other prediction markets is unlicensed sports wagering operators offering the same bets as sports folks like FanDuel and DraftKings, but without paying the taxes or adhering to the reporting standards. But Kalshi, in its lawsuit, argued event contracts offered on prediction markets should be exclusively regulated by the Federal Commodities Futures Trading Commission. And so that's what the argument is. And how it plays out will have a significant impact on the state's financial, in that the Wagering Act provides a 1.7% tax on the first 5 million wagers made on prediction markets, 3.5% for wagers made after. And it would require Kalshi and other similar ventures to obtain an Illinois sports betting license. And those cost $15 million initially, valid for 4 years. Subsequent renewals, it costed $1 million. So there's a lot of money involved in this. And as I say, it's unclear how this is going to play out in the courts.
Well, a couple of minutes left here. I wanted to get through a couple of other items really quickly. Isabella, fill us in on some LGBTQ+ inspired legislation that is out there. I know one of those kind of follows on the heels of some abortion related legislation when it comes to medical records of people not being allowed to have out-of-state parties get those.
Yeah, so this is actually a pretty interesting bill. I was following it throughout this session alongside the abortion privacy bill. It removes testosterone from the list of drugs that is monitored by the Illinois Prescription Drug Monitoring Program. That program was originally established to track opioid distribution throughout the state, who's prescribed opioids, who is prescribing opioids, and things like that. So I'm not sure when testosterone was added to the list of things that were tracked by the program, but it has now been removed, and it's kind of preventing other states or, you know, the federal government from accessing those records to see who has been prescribed testosterone and things like that. It was an interesting bill to follow, and the debate between this bill and the abortion privacy bill were pretty similar. You know, Democrats who were championing the legislation are concerned, obviously, about outside access to medical records, while on the Republican side, you know, they're concerned that doctors may not have all the information that they need when treating a patient. So it was an interesting bill to follow.
And also, there was a law taking effect requiring insurance companies to cover up to 6 months of the prescribed hormone therapy. But let me save just a little bit of time here, Charlie, just a few seconds to talk really quickly about something else that's been in the news that we admittedly do not have a lot of detail on, but it is still fascinating to watch, and that is the Illinois House Speaker, Chris Welch, issuing a message to the Representative Harry Benton to resign from his seat, or he says they will take action against him to expel him from the House. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's very interesting, and it's extremely rare. Obviously, the most obvious example of somebody being removed from office was when Rod Blagojevich was impeached and removed. And we don't know all the details involved in the case of Benton. And this is some 5 months after Welch kicked Benton out of the Democratic caucus, stripped him of his committee assignments with no public explanation. But what Welch said is that there was an investigation, and this is a quote from Welch, the legislative inspector general's findings reveal clear patterns of conduct by Representative Benton that are outrageous, unethical, and unbecoming a member of the Illinois House of Representatives. And Benton, according to the news stories, has not responded yet. So if, in fact, the decision is made to expel him, I believe it takes 79 affirmative votes to a two-thirds vote of the full House to kick him out.
He is on the ballot for this fall as well, as we should mention also.
If there was a case with Representative Derek Smith, a Chicago Democrat, who was expelled in 2012. It came after he was accused of taking a $7,000 cash bribe. But he won re-election to the House the following election, and he was finally removed automatically when he was convicted of bribery in 2014.
I remember that case. Let's go down to our notes from the field, and Charlie, we'll let you go.
Well, the Illinois Flash Index ended the fiscal year on a strong note, rising to 101.4 from its 101.1 level in May. That was reported by U of I Professor Emeritus Fred Geertz this week. And his quote is, "The last 2 months have seen a modest rebound from the index's year-long downward trend. Both the national and Illinois economies continue to experience slow growth amid ongoing economic and political uncertainty. Strong recent employment gains and persistent inflation have prompted the Federal Reserve, under its new leadership, to keep interest rates unchanged rather than pursue the rate cuts advocated by President Trump." And so he said, for the fiscal year ending June 30th, combined revenues from the largest tax resources, the individual income tax, the corporate tax, and sales tax, were up over the last fiscal year in real terms, led by strong individual income tax receipts.
Well, that is all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Hopefully you enjoy your Independence Day weekend. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Illinois Public Radio's Isabella Nieto. Look for State Week, where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.
Support for State Week comes from the members of the Illinois Education Association, serving 135,000 members of educators and support professionals around Illinois. IEA's mission is to promote excellence and equity in public education. When schools and communities unite, we all win. Resources and membership information at ieanea.org.